or it's too late. I don't know what that means, but I just got this message. And so, of course, she rolled her eyes and ignored me. And then a couple days go by, and we're driving along again in a different environment, and she goes, "Oh, why did I agree to go to this thing? I don't want to go. I wish I had said that I couldn't go, but now it's too late. They're already planning on me being there." And I said, "Oh, I've got a great idea. Hold on one second. Sending a message to the past. Tell her, cancel now before it's too late." I said, "Did it work?" And she wasn't as amused as anything. So most husbands would just tell their wife, "I told you so." But I go through this elaborate the charade and skit to do this. And so if wives, if you're ever frustrated that your husband tells you, "I told you so," just remember, it could be a lot worse. It could be a lot worse. That was obviously just a playful example. But God himself actually has that ability. He has that ability to take something that is going to happen sometime in the future and send a message back to the past and let people know that something special is going to happen. But let me start out with just a quick recap of Mark. For those of you who haven't necessarily been with us on this journey, we've been stepping through Mark for quite a while. And I don't know about you, but even if I have been in it, sometimes I just need to get reoriented what is in the world is going on. So let's just start with who was Mark? Who was Mark? Mark is a companion of Peter and a companion later of Paul. And we see Mark appear later in Acts as there's Paul and with Peter interacting that he knows them and he travels with them. There's some conflict and things we can read all about that in Acts and later into the epistles. But just keep in mind that this guy who's writing this stuff down, he's a friend of Peter and a friend of Paul. Now his name was really John Mark. And just keep in mind that at this time, it just seems like a lot of people were named John. So we've got John the Beloved. That's a different person. He's the one who wrote the book of John, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John as well. We just call him John. That's the way we do it. And then there's that John who was out in the wilderness doing all that baptizing. Oh, we already have a John. Let's call him John the Baptist. And then for John Mark, just like, look, we're kind of sick of assigning these John names. We're just going to call him Mark, and that's what it is. And so we've got the gospel according to Mark. And so God supernaturally inspired Mark to capture the events from the life of Christ. But the narrative, as he's heard it, he's probably mostly relying on accounts from Peter himself. Peter was there. You can see him as a participant in much of this gospel. He would be there. He'd be an eyewitness to it. Mark is probably capturing down things from Peter's perspective. And I think that that's important, especially as we go through, especially this gospel, and any time that Peter says something that we're just like, "Peter, come on." This is Peter saying right out in front, he's the one saying, "Mark, write this down. This is what I did. This is what I said. This is the things that happened," and they weren't necessarily the most wise and smart things to say at the time. But it's Peter self-admitting what those narratives are. A lot of people also, when some people are questioning whether or not the Bible is true or it's real, it is very uncommon for the stars of the narrative to talk about the things that they've done incorrectly or that they've done wrong. And if you do see the people who are supposed to be the heroes or supposed to be the people who are in charge, or even the people who are writing the story, when you see their flaws coming out, it just gives all that more credence to the fact that this is an accurate account of what's happened. Let's just say, so that's who Mark was. He wrote this stuff down. So what's happened, and let's just say we're in chapter 14 today, but in the first 10 chapters, we're covering pretty much from the very, very beginning of Christ's ministry to about three and some change years later. And so there's about 375 verses in the first 10 chapters of Mark, and that covers about 180 weeks. So I did some fancy math, and I plugged those two numbers into a calculator and said, that means on average, Mark was writing down about two verses for every week of Jesus' ministry. You could question my math, and you could come back and tell me that's a little off. It's not more than 2.5. It's not less than 1.5. It's somewhere around two verses per week as we go through. And so what has happened during that? Well, it starts with the baptism of Jesus. Then he goes out and he gets tempted in the wilderness. And then there's a lot of instances of him performing miracles, him telling parables, telling things that are just proclaiming truth to people, and a lot of things proving who he is. That happens in the first 10 chapters of the book of Mark. And then in the next handful of chapters are devoted to just covering a single week. There's about 219 verses that cover this single week. So remember, this was two verses per week for the first part of his ministry, 200 verses for this week. So we're talking that as Mark is going, he has taken a chance to say, okay, here's a big ministry, and let's zoom way in as we look at this last week leading up to the crucifixion. So what has happened so far this week? He's had debates with the Pharisees. It's not going well for them as far as the other side of these debates. He's performing healings. We hear the account of Palm Sunday where he comes riding in and people are celebrating. He goes through and he cleanses the temple. This is a big week. There's a lot going on. This has all happened in after what we've talked about for the past handful of months here at church. All this stuff is all happening in this last week. He's telling parables. A few weeks ago, we talked about how he's instructing his disciples about his second coming, giving them insight to that. And then Dan preached last week, and what were they doing? They were making arrangements for the Passover, and they were beginning that meal. So again, now we're zooming in. Now we're zooming into just now a couple of hours, right? That's where this passage is zooming into. And so my question that I'm wondering for myself is that the Pharisees and the religious leaders, why are they getting so upset about this? Even if we go all the way back into the beginning of Mark, Mark 3:6 says, "And the Pharisees went forth and straightway took counsel with the Herodians against him, how they might destroy him." So this has been going on for quite a while. And keep in mind that when we think of the Pharisees, easy for us to say, Pharisee, oh, that just means bad guy, right? That's the way we've grown up in churches, that's what that means. But keep in mind that this was the religious good guy. These were the religious people who have been doing what they thought was the right thing to do to try to retain the Jewish traditions throughout the years, to help instruct people, to give people knowledge about this. But what's happened is that since their original message was developed of what God had actually told them, they had continuously put other things onto it and tried to establish this, and in some ways, I think, in a well-intentioned way, tried to make things and just said, here's the best way to do this. Here's the best way to follow these rules. Here's the best way to follow these laws. And then all of a sudden, those became the laws, and then they became putting more and more things on it. And they would have been the ones that would have studied the fact that there's a Messiah coming. But they had it in their head. The Messiah was going to be this very, very specific thing that was going to look in this very specific way, and Jesus did not necessarily measure up to the things that they had in their head. We'll see throughout here that Jesus measures up exactly to what is stated for us in the Old Testament regarding prophecy, regarding himself, but the Pharisees had in mind that this is not the guy. So, but when it comes down to it, who really cares about some crazy person with silly ideas? That doesn't make people upset. We see and hear people all the time that will say things that we're just like, boy, that's wrong, or I disagree with it. And they might be about from any topic that we could think about. And we're just like, okay, whatever. You say your thing, that's fine with me. But what makes that person who's saying all these things that that you disagree with, what makes them a problem is that when other people start believing it, he starts convincing other people. Other people are starting to get on board. The Pharisees are kind of in a panic, right? Because they're saying, Jesus is saying all these things about himself. It'd be one thing if he was just off on his own doing his thing, but people are starting to follow him. People are starting to come. He's starting to really attract a crowd. We've got a big problem as the religious leaders in the church, or at the time, were saying, look, this person who's doing this is really becoming a big disruption. The government is also feeling like that as well, because they're calling him a king. And we're the ones in charge. We can't have a new person coming on the scene saying that they're the king. So it gets problematic as people start to believe something. It's one thing if people are just saying something, but it's another thing when people start to believe it. My example on this is, and I apologize if there's any, I don't really apologize. If there's anyone in here who is a flat earther, I apologize. This is going to sound a little bit insulting for a second. But there's been people for a long time who've said, you know what, I don't think the earth is round, I think it's flat, and there's all these reasons why I think that this is the case. And they've been largely just disregarded. But if you haven't noticed, in the past handful of years, because of people being able to spread things around on TikTok and Instagram or whatever, just all this social media, it's all of a sudden there's becoming a following. There's people who are actually saying, hey, you know what, they have a good point. I guess I've never been up to space myself and seen it in a circle, so you know, maybe there's some point to this. And it's inspired that some of the scientific minds that we have right now are actually responding to it, you know, because they feel like I need to say something. Because it was one thing when nobody believed it, but now that somebody actually believes this, we need to do something about this before it gets out of hand. And I think that's where the Pharisees were as well, is like, we've got to put a stop to this, and this is a very serious issue. So today, we're going to jump in and we're going to go to the next part of the Passover that Jesus and his disciples were having. And this is occurring somewhere in the middle of this zoomed-in week that Mark is helping us to focus on. So first, we've already started. You know, they made preparations for the Passover. They're already in it. But let's just recap again. What is the Passover? Remember this, that the Passover represents this very pivotal turning point for the people of Israel, for the Jewish people. It's when they essentially went from being slaves to being a nation. This is the point that needed to happen to make all this happen. So if you recall, God's people, through the Jacob's family, back in the time of Joseph, they migrated down to Egypt because there was a famine in the land. They stayed there after those people had died off. That family continued to stay there, and eventually the Egyptians didn't look favorably on them, and they made them into slaves that were part of that land. And so the Israelites are stuck there in Egypt, and through Moses is born, he grows up, and he is called by God to help set these people free. And so Moses works with Pharaoh and says, we need to let these people go, we need to take off, and we're gonna leave. And Pharaoh over and over again disagrees, and we get to a point where God says, we know the way we're gonna do this is that we're gonna convince him one way or another. And we go through these 9 terrible plagues that are inflicted upon the Egyptians for not letting the Jewish people go. And even through all that, Pharaoh says no. And it comes down to the last plague, and the last plague is the death of the firstborn son of all of the people in Egypt. And before that actually happens, God's people are given a special instruction to they are to have a special meal, and they're to put the blood of a lamb over the sides of their door. And this was going to be an indication that this that the angel that comes through and is inflicting this plague on everyone, he will pass over the houses that have that blood applied to it. And then, so that happens, that spares many of God's people, and also is enough to say that Pharaoh says, look, get out of here. We're done with you. Get out of Egypt. And so the people finally leave leave their exile, I mean their capture in Egypt. Exodus 12, 26 and 27 actually asks and answers this exact question about what is Passover. And it says this, and it shall come to pass when your children say to you, what mean ye by the service? That you will say, it is the sacrifice of the Lord's Passover, who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians and delivered our houses, and the people bowed the head and worshipped. So that is the origin of Passover. Now, Passover wasn't something that just happened at that one time. It wasn't just a single event. God commanded them to continue to in this practice of observing the Passover, and the observation was supposed to be is supposed to be on the 14th of Nisan, which is a Jewish month, and that's not the month of the calendars that we have right now. But today is the 12th of Nisan is today. At sundown today, it will be the 13th of Nisan, and that means at sundown tomorrow, it's going to be the 14th, and that would be when Passover begins. So if you have any friends in the Jewish community, that's what they're beginning their Passover. So this is very timely that we're talking about all of this today, this idea of Passover. This is, we are right on the eve of Passover as well. So how did they observe Passover in Jesus' day? And it's important to know that the observation of Passover that is happening right now could have developed in tradition over the years. So we don't know exactly what it was like. We know what God commanded them to do. And we have accounts like this one that we're about to read that's going to tell us something about how the Passover was actually observed. We know that there was scripture that was read and recited. There was kind of this question and answer back and forth with children, because the whole goal of this was to pass it on. It needs to be passed on to the next generation. So there was a lot of involvement of the kids, a lot of involvement of young people. The youngest people in the actual ceremony were encouraged to participate in a lot of it. Because, and it's genius the way that it's set up, because it was meant to be something that just continued to be passed on from generation to generation. It involves drinking the wine. It involves eating unleavened bread, the things that are mentioned in this passage that we're about to read. And it has a lot of other elements and traditions that are part of it. And throughout the whole ceremony, there is the singing of some of the psalms. This says in our passage, singing a hymn, but that would be their hymn book is the psalms that they have there. So my first point that I want to talk about today is the Passover revealed. The Passover revealed. I titled the message The Long Foreshadow, and the reason is this, is that foreshadowing is something that an author does to give you a sense that something big is about to happen. It's a clue to what's coming next. So as many of you watch movies or whatever, you can always kind of sense that foreshadowing that's coming up. So this would be an example. Let's say that we have, in a movie, we have a bunch of friends. They're all saying, hey, let's go do something. They're going to go leave the house. And one friend is walking out the door and says, oh, I forgot my cell phone in there. And the other friend goes, nah, you don't need your cell phone. We'll just be gone for a few minutes. It won't matter if you have your cell phone or not. And now in movie language, what that means is you're going to be gone for a long time and you're going to really wish you had your cell phone. But when we see those things, we know what foreshadowing is. We know that something is going to happen when we see that in a work of fiction. But remember that God is the author of reality. He has the ability to weave foreshadowing into his story through actual, true, factual events. And we call this, sometimes we call it prophecy, but I like to imagine it as this divine creativity, as God is putting all of these events together and giving messages to those in the past to tell them about the future. But it's a divine creativity and some supernatural story writing by the true author of all of reality. So in verse 22, it says, "As they did eat, Jesus took bread and blessed and broke it, and he gave it to them and said, 'Take, eat, this is my body.'" Now for us, we've been in church for any period of time, we've heard those words a number of times, and they tend to roll over us because we know this is just something that's commonly said and we've heard it many times. But I'm guessing that when the disciples heard that statement, "This is my body," that a million thoughts started rolling through their heads. Keep in mind that the Passover tradition has always called for bread, but it wasn't until Jesus explained it that they could see why it was a part of the tradition. For about 1,200 years before that date, the Jewish people had been observing the feast and with all its symbolism, and then Jesus simply reveals in this one statement, "This is my body," why this has been happening for all this time. And so in my imagination, I'm imagining Jewish families and friends breaking that bread together over and over and over again, and not even quite aware of the picture that they were painting throughout. So we're way back in the past, and this is the year after the first Passover, as they're moving into the wilderness. They get together, they follow the tradition, they break the bread. Then, a couple years later, they're actually in the new promised land. They're sitting under the judges, and another family breaks the bread. And then after that, they've taken a king. They've got King Saul, and they're still observing what they're supposed to do, and another family breaks the bread. Then under King David, they break the bread. And then even while they're in exile in Babylon, they break the bread. And even after they start to restore the temple, they're getting together and they're breaking the bread. And all of this comes down to a year before this particular event. They got together, probably with Jesus and the disciples, and they did it then and broke the bread. And now we're at the point, this time right here, Jesus reveals, "That's what it's been all about. That's my body. It's been broken. Broken for you." And so we can continue on. In verses 23 and 24, he says, "And he took the cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, and they drank all of it. And he said unto them, 'This is my blood of the New Testament, which is shed for many.'" This is the blood of the New Testament, which is shed for many. So Jesus continues to reveal the foreshadowing. This is a different aspect of the Passover Seder, the cup of wine. He tells us the wine has always been a picture of his blood as a payment for us. He says that this blood is shed for many. And so he's not just talking about the 11 of them, including himself, the 12 of them that are still in the room. He's not talking about just them. He's talking about many. This blood is shed for many. And this is what I love when I read through different passages of the Bible. I try to find the places where God mentions us, and I see us in this word many. So this is a place where they decided to write it down so that years into the future, we would see, that's me. I'm one. I'm one of the many. I'm one of the many that blood was shed for. By doing this, there's a lot of symbolism, and we only have time to just touch on some just a little bit here. There's a lot of symbolism in almost every word of what Christ is speaking right here, But there is some prophecies from the Old Testament that involve the cup and the new covenant. So what's he talking about when he says there's the blood of the New Testament or the new covenant, new agreement, the new contract that is happening now? In Jeremiah 31, it says this, "Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel, with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they broke, although I was a husband to them, saith the Lord. But this shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, saith the Lord, I will put my law in their inward parts, I will write it in their hearts, and will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall teach no more everywhere in his neighbor, and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for they shall all know me. From the least of them unto the greatest of them, saith the Lord, I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more." So Jeremiah tells us that this new covenant is going to be much different than the first covenant. The law now will be written on our hearts. We will have a close relationship with God, and the amazing part of it is that our sins will be forgiven. There's another passage that compares Jesus to the cup, and this is in Isaiah 53. He says, "He shall see the travail of his soul and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many, for he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he hath poured out his soul unto death, and he was numbered with the transgressors, and he bare the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors." So Isaiah tells us how the Messiah will be poured out. He will justify many. He will bear their sins. His soul will be poured out unto death, and he will be there among the criminals. We see the fulfillment of the foreshadowing of the Passover, but at the same time, we simultaneously see Jesus institute a new practice of the Lord's Supper. And so he goes, this single time that they're sitting here, this couple of verses that we're studying today is connecting two very long traditions. He connects them both. So we have the 1,200 years of the past of the observance of the Passover combined in this one meal with the institution of the Lord's Supper that is going to continue for thousands of years to come. And this all came together on this one night in these handful of verses that we've read many, many, many times before, but it brings everything right together that he's connected these two very long-running traditions. So let's move on and read verse 25 says, "Verily I say unto you, I will drink no more of the fruit of the vine until that day that I drink it anew in the kingdom of God." And Jesus is letting them know that this is it. The night has come. They're not going to have any more dinners together. This was the time. This is the end. And he's letting them know that. And as we move on, in verse 26, he says, "And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives." And it's important to know that hymn singing was a part of the tradition of the Passover meal. And they sang different things throughout the meal. But the general assumption, as I've looked into it, is that they sang Psalm 115 through 118 at the end of the meal. And so that would have meant that as they were, whatever they're mentioning here about them singing a song and heading out to the Mount of Olives, this would have been the last little bit of Psalm 118 that they would have been singing. And listen to the words, because these were written for all of these Passover meals. This is what they were doing as a tradition for all of these years in the past. But keep in mind that we are anticipating the events of the next 24 hours or so and Jesus' willingness as he goes to his death. We're going to just listen for the tragic nature of the cross, but at the same time that there's a contrast of how joyful and thankful we should be. So let me just read a little bit of it. It says, this is from Psalm 118, "Open to me the gates of righteousness, I will go into them, and I'll praise the Lord. This gave the Lord, into which the righteous shall enter. I will praise thee, for thou hast heard me and art become my salvation. The stone which the builders rejected is become the headstone of the corner. This is the Lord's doing. It's marvelous in our eyes. This is the day which the Lord has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it. Save now, I beseech thee, O Lord. O Lord, I beseech thee, send now prosperity. Blessed be he that cometh in the name of the Lord, for we have blessed you out of the house of the Lord. God is the Lord, which has showed us light. Bind the sacrifice with cords, even unto the horns of the altar. Thou art my God, and I will praise thee. Thou art my God, I will exalt thee. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, and his mercy endureth forever. That's the song that they were probably singing as they were heading out to the Mount of Olives. And keep in mind, the Mount of Olives, where they were, this is probably where they had been spending some time. We're not talking about Judas at all today. He appeared last week, and he'll appear next week, I'm sure. But Judas isn't with them. But this is probably a place where they have gone. They've spent a lot of time during this week. What we know is that Judas knows where to find them. They're going a place. They're not running. They're not hiding. They're going to a place where Jesus is aware that Judas will be able to meet up with them at some point. So let's move on to the second point of the hope of his resurrection. The hope of his resurrection. We start with first the bad news. Verse 27 says, "And Jesus said unto them, All ye shall be offended because of me this night. For it is written, I will smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered." So he says, all of you will be offended of me this night. So offended means something a little differently back then than it does today. Today, offended can mean that I want to shut you down because you said something that I don't like, and maybe it insulted me, or maybe it's just an opinion that I don't agree with. But our culture right now, the word offended usually means something that is just easily something that throws me off, and I don't deserve to be offended, so I don't want to be offended. The offended in the Bible means something a little different. It means to put a stumbling block in somebody's way. We know these phrases from the Bible, whosoever offends these little ones, or if your hand or foot offend you. These are the things where these things are in your way. You are standing in the way of things happening. So Jesus explains that the events of the night will cause a big disruption and will inevitably cause the disciples to stumble. And he wants them to understand this is going to be difficult for them to deal with. This is going to be a challenge for them. In that verse 27, he says, for it is written, and then he quotes Zechariah 13:7, and this is what Zechariah 13:7 actually says. It says, "Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, and against the man that is my fellow, saith the Lord of hosts. Smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered, and I will turn my hand upon the little ones." What he quotes is, "I will smite the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered," a clear reference to Zechariah 13:7, and tells us that the leader, the one who is in charge, the shepherd that is in charge, will be taken down, and all of the followers will run away. So that's the bad news. That's verse 27. And verse 28 says, "But after that, I'm risen, and I'll go before you to Galilee." And what I find fascinating as I read through this is that the disciples don't seem to address that part of it at all. He says, "After I am risen," and they don't respond to that part. They only respond to, "What do you mean scatter?" that seems to be the thing that they're focused on. But his message is, after this is all done, let's get together in Galilee. we're going to be all together again. He's telling them the next few hours and days are going to be rough, but you are going to scatter. But after I rise again, I will see you again in Galilee. And me personally, as we see through this, Jesus tells them time and time again, he says, "I'm going to be killed, and I'm coming back. I will rise again." He says that a number of times throughout the Gospels, and it seems like every single time And especially as we see the account of the disciples during that actual time when Jesus is in the grave, is they have no idea. They seem like they are just depressed, and they don't know what to do. They're scared. They just don't see the future coming. And but Jesus tried to tell them over and over and over again. And I really shouldn't be too critical of the disciples for this. This is something that is beyond their comprehension. We know because we've seen it. We've seen the story. We've heard the story. We know how it ends. And when we look back on it, say, come on, guys. How did you not pick up on these things? Some of them, he's being really explicit about what it is, including this one, I think. In this verse, he says, after I'm risen, this will happen. But the disciples don't seem to be very focused on that. My third point, and we're moving right along here, the disciples try to resist. The disciples try to resist. So I'll read again the next couple of verses. But Peter said unto him, although all shall be offended, yet will not I. And Jesus said unto him, verily, I say unto you, this day, even this night, before the cock crow twice, you're going to deny me three times. But he spake the more vehemently, if I should die with you, I will not deny thee in any wise. Likewise said they all. So keep in mind that just a little while ago, while they were at, and this is what we talked about last week, at the beginning of the Passover meal, Jesus mentioned that someone was going to betray him. I don't think they've quite caught on that there's only one of them that's not with them right now, but I think that the disciples are also very weird. They ask themselves, and we thought and we said that that was a good thing. They're asking, is it me? Is it me? I want to be aware. If something's like this is going to happen, I just need to know. Am I the one? Everyone is probably on their guard because Jesus said, well, somebody's going to betray me, and they're just like, this better not be me. This better not be me. I'm not going to be the one who does it. And so when Peter says, I'm not going to run, I'm not going to do any of this, when he's saying all that, he is probably somewhat reacting to the fact that Jesus has just told them that there's a betrayer right in between them. Peter wants to believe that he isn't capable of betraying Jesus. And he actually claims, look, if I have to stand with you and I have to be the one that dies before you do, I will do it. I will be the one who is willing to die with you or for you. Now, Jesus, in his response, I don't think he implies any judgment, but he restates the prediction for the future. And I think when he talks about the fact that the rooster is going to crow and it's going to happen three times, and it's for you specifically, Peter, I believe that Jesus wants them all to know this is the plan. When you see this stuff happening, you will know this is all going exactly as I knew that it would, and this is the plan. So the more details I give you, the more confident you'll be that this is something that was clearly understood and clearly foretold. Well, when all this happens and Jesus gives that additional prediction and more detail, the other disciples join with Peter. They double down on Peter's statement and say that no one is going to abandon him. They don't want to believe the passage in Zechariah that says that the shepherd will be struck down and the sheep will scatter. They can't imagine that that applies to them. I can imagine some of these guys, and we've seen them at work. We know some of their personality. I could imagine them saying, we aren't sheep. We're your bodyguards. We're the ones who take care of you. Remember when those kids tried to talk to you? We're the ones who shoot them away. Remember when those sick people came? We said, stay away from him. And Jesus probably thank you for all the help. They're the people who said, we try to protect you from the crowds. We're the ones who are holding people back, and we're trying to help you get through big mobs of people. We're your trusted friends, and we're insulted that you assume that we would run when you're in trouble. So I try not to be too critical of Peter here either. We know that Peter is trying to stand up and say, I'm willing to fight to make sure this sequence of events doesn't happen. Peter cares very deeply for Jesus, and he can't imagine what it would be like not to be there for him in this moment of darkness. As I was studying for this message, I came across a concept from Mike Winger, and he was talking a little bit about some of the things that he had studied in this passage, and I thought one thing was pretty interesting that he came up with. He contrasted the heroic acts of bravery with being faithful in the small and everyday things, and we'll see what we're talking about. Next week, in Dan's message, we're going to talk about the fact that Peter is willing to take up arms against the soldiers. When they come to get him, he is just like, no, I told you, I'm going to stand with you no matter what. I'm drawing my sword, and he goes and he performs some ear surgery, and we'll get into that next week. But the point of it is that Peter isn't lying about his intentions. Peter's intentions were that I'm walking up into a soldier with my sword drawn. This is not a good plan for me. I am brave, and I'm capable, and I'm willing to do it. But when he's alone, and when he's just by himself, and the simple questions of, do you know this guy? Do you know this guy? No, I don't know him. I don't know him. And even more vehemently, as time goes on, that's Peter will go through this denial. Those are things that are the simple, everyday things that we have the ability to do something with on a day-to-day basis. And there's the big, heroic things that we want to be able to know, that we want to be able to think, I would stand in that situation, but struggle with some of the things that are just the more simple day-to-day. Like, for instance, how many of us would claim that we'd be willing to take a bullet for a family member, but then also, so this is the big heroic act, but we find it difficult to show those small acts of kindness to the family member who might be getting on your nerves or doing something, just on the day-to-day. I would do this big thing, but the small things are hard. Who'd be willing to take on the government if they said that we didn't have a right to assemble in our church? They would say, no, we are going to stand for this. We're going to do whatever it takes. We are going to not let that happen. But then, do we take advantage of our ability to gather to worship today? Are we always able to make that a priority? Yes, we would do the big thing, but the small things sometimes are a little harder to do. We're often willing to passionately defend a principle while we struggle to live out the small decisions that we have to make every day. And I don't think this is just blatant hypocrisy. I think it's just the consistency of everyday life can sometimes be harder than we expect. Distractions and temptations keep us from acting out what we know is right. Another example, do we praise God for his miraculous preservation of the Bible, and we'll stand for it, and we say, this is the Bible, this is the Word of God, but then we forget to read it? And are we thankful for the way God answers prayer? And we might even say there's big things that God is doing because of prayer, and then we forget to actually spend time in prayer on a daily basis. So we see the big, the small is sometimes really, really hard. Our lives, though, are defined by the small decisions that we make every day, not just the things that are giant, not just the things that are big, not just the things that are pivotal. We are defined by the things that we do in the small moments, day after day after day. So what can we do to add a small habit to our daily lives to continue to grow in our relationship with God? So as I wrap up here, let's just summarize what we've talked about. During the week of the crucifixion, lots of foreshadowing and prophesying were all converging on this single point in time. Time and space are bending to make themselves fit into what we have here happening in these last few days before the crucifixion. Jesus reveals that the Passover meal represented his body and blood in sacrifice for us that had been observed for many years into the past. And nearly every word that Jesus speaks, at least the words that are captured by Mark in these passages, ties together messianic prophecies from the Old Testament. In the process, he institutes a new practice of the observance of the Lord's Supper, which is shown to be something that is commanded to be regularly repeated from this time forward. We see those commands later in the epistles. Jesus is revealing the past while also revealing facts about the future of the next few days and hours, including his sacrifice on the cross and his resurrection. He also predicts that another testament, that another Old Testament prophecy will come true, and that is namely that the disciples will scatter upon his death, which they can't comprehend, and they're willing to argue with him to try to prevent it. Jesus was very confident that all these things would happen, and despite the fact that he knew all these things, he willingly allowed these things to happen. He broke his body and he shed his blood. He was willing to go through the pain of having his friends abandon him, and he wanted to do his best, even in this time when he was going to be suffering. He wanted to do his best to reassure his friends that even though these are the darkest days, the best is yet to come. So Jesus cares for us just like he cares for his disciples. We are the ones that rebel against him. We deny him. We're the ones who are prone to scatter when all he wants is for us to stay. We fall short of every expectation that he has for us, but we're still the ones that he chose to die for. He gave up his life for us. He willingly went to the cross, even though he could foresee every possible way that he could have gotten out of it. He could see everything that was happening. He knew Judas was coming. He knew the soldiers were coming. He knew exactly, and he could have, with that foresight, he could have found any way that he wanted to get out of it, but he chose not to. So if we believe in him, Jesus can see down through time from his time on the cross and willingly put our faults, our problems, our sins, he can put them on himself so that he could suffer in our place. And if there's anyone here that's not a belief that you already have and an understanding that you already have, then I would encourage you to find out more. Ask a question to somebody that you know here. Don't be embarrassed to start a conversation to find out what it means to put your faith in Jesus.